Truth News Radio Australia, broadcasting to you on the 12th of July 2014. My name's Hereward Fenton. Great pleasure to be with you today. Well, folks, there's a lot going on in the world. There's a whole range of topics that we would like to cover today. I'm going to try to address some of them, and on diverse aspects of things that are pretty much the core of what we are interested in on this show, is trying to differentiate between spin, deception, and outright lies, and the facts. And there are so many things that are transpiring that are subject to complete distortion. And it is very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. I feel for people these days who are trying to understand their world and who end up being drawn into various lines of propaganda, who magnify ignorant points of view. It's very easy to be drawn into that kind of situation where you do that. It takes incredible effort and vigilance to actually shake off the threads of propaganda that are constantly being dropped upon you, because there's just so many of them. And a lot of us don't have the time. We don't have the freedom in our life to spend that much time trying to figure out what is going on and trying to shake off all of the lies, all the rubbish, all the detritus of the deceptive people and organizations and companies and news organizations and governments that are just trying to confuse you because they are pursuing their power-hungry schemes of global domination, economic control, and trying to take power away from the people and concentrate it more and more into a criminal elite. Anyway, having said that, let's just dive in and begin with the situation in Gaza. The Gaza death toll today has passed 100, and Israel has vowed to counteract the rockets, which are currently landing in Israel, with all power. An airstrike outside a family home early Saturday pushed the Palestinian death toll past 100 in 4 days of cross-border fighting, as Israel showed no sign of pausing, despite international pressure to negotiate a ceasefire with militants. Asked if Israel might move from the mostly aerial attacks of the past 4 days into a ground war in Gaza to stop militant rocket fire, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu replied, "We are weighing all possibilities and preparing for all possibilities. No international pressure will prevent us from acting with all power." Okay, that's a report there from Reuters. Now, the rockets, which are the current cause of the incredible, the blistering, the magnificent blitzkrieg of the Israeli Defense Forces against Gaza, have actually wounded one person, apparently. Up till yesterday, there had been no injuries at all, no damage. I mean, the rockets, which are mostly these homemade ones, I'll talk about that in a minute, but the rockets have been landing in fields, and apparently one was blown up by the amazing Iron Dome super protection secret system that they use, but you know, that was one. The rockets don't have any navigation, so they tend to just land where they land. But anyway, a rocket seriously wounded one person and injured seven Israelis when a fuel tanker was hit at a service station in Ashdod, 20 miles north of Gaza. Palestinian militants warned international airlines they would fire rockets at Tel Aviv's main airport. Israel said it was determined to end cross-border rocket attacks that had intensified after its forces arrested hundreds of activists from the Hamas movement in the occupied West Bank following the abduction there of three Jewish teenagers who were later found killed. Israel's campaign will continue until we are certain that quiet returns to Israeli citizens. Now, let's just talk about these rockets for a minute, because I think it's an interesting topic and one which is filled with disinformation. I've got an article here from NBC. Hamas firing China-designed, Syria-made M302 rockets. And this is according to Israel. Smuggled Syrian-made rockets based on a Chinese design have boosted Hamas's 10,000-strong arsenal, which is dominated by crude homemade devices. A surface-to-surface weapon that struck the coastal town of Hadera, 30 miles north of Tel Aviv, and 70 miles from the Gaza Strip, is an M302-type rocket, similar to a shipment of rockets Israel intercepted at sea in March. Okay, well, that sounds pretty serious, doesn't it? And, you know, I'd be very concerned if there was a rain of these types of rockets coming down in Israel. But then the following paragraph says, we understand that there are several other tens of these rockets within the Gaza Strip that can potentially reach that long distance. So they really only have a few, and that sounds like a guess, and that's coming from the IDF. But there has been a lot of pumping up in the news about this, but really, the reality is, and this is explained here, the reality is that the vast majority, I'm talking probably at least 95% of the so-called rockets, are the homemade Qassam rockets. And of the hundreds that have been fired, and this is an article from a couple of days ago, nobody in Israel has been killed. And the National Security Advisor to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu added that none of them is any kind of game-changing doomsday weapon. Most of the rockets fired at the center of the country are makeshift Gaza-made ones. So that is the truth of the matter. Now, what I can also tell you from having studied this in the past is that these rockets have no warheads. They don't have explosives. Occasionally they do, very rarely. But 9 times out of 10, these rockets are really just projectiles. And they can only cause damage if they hit a building, and then they typically put a hole in the roof of a building if they do that. In the case where one of the rockets hit a truck, well, that is one way that they certainly can cause damage if they hit a truck and the truck exploded. But the point to understand, and it is really quite a bizarre question that needs to be understood, is that these rockets do not have warheads. Now, I just struggle to understand this. I struggle to understand how the Hamas militants, after all these years, and with their alleged help from Iran and Syria, why they are firing these pointless, toothless projectiles into Israel, which has no other effect than to guarantee a blitzkrieg against their own territory, killing hundreds of people every time it happens. I cannot see any rational reason why the Hamas militants, who are allegedly fanatically opposed to Israel, would do such an idiotic thing. But I can totally understand why elements within the security and intelligence services in Israel would facilitate this very action. Call it a conspiracy theory if you want. I mean, I can't back it up with any evidence, and I'm never going to be able to. This sort of thing is virtually impossible to track down. But it's just a que bono type situation. Who benefits? You know, it's clear who benefits from these idiotic toy rockets being fired at Israel. Israel benefits. And, of course, the armaments manufacturers benefit from the massive use of firepower used to crack down. And, of course, the power-hungry empire builders in the Israeli regime benefit. The only people that don't benefit are the Palestinians. I've long been of the opinion that Hamas is not really acting in the interests of the Palestinian people. And of course, remember, Hamas was put in place. Hamas came into power as a result of the death of Yasser Arafat, which is another event that's shrouded in controversy. And Arafat, for all that he was attacked for by Israel, he was incredibly moderate and incredibly, a diplomat and a statesman compared to the Hamas extremists, who just come across as being some sort of faceless group. I mean, we never even have any clear individuals that pop up that that act on a diplomatic level. It seems to me that Hamas is a dream come true for Israel. And again, I theorize, I hypothesize that Hamas and the rocket people are being handled by the intelligence services. And look, it's not easy, not hard to do. It's the sort of thing that happens all the time. It's been happening for decades. It's happened in many different conflicts around the world. Is that you play the other side. You create a strategy of tension. It was exposed in Europe in the 70s and 80s as being a creation of the intelligence services to facilitate stricter control and to give the policing authorities more power to allow for the passing of legislation that gives the government more power and control. So, of course, in the case of Israel, we're dealing with these territories which sort of are technically outside of Israel, but Israel considers them to be part of Israel, actually. And those who are the forces behind the empire building of Israel would eventually like to see these regions simply conquered and absorbed back into Israel. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's a great pleasure to be talking to you today, and I will be right back after this very short break. Don't go away.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. Well, folks, it's now time for me to do my regular marketing promotion for Truth News, as I've been doing every week on this show, trying to drum up financial support for our enterprise here. I launched subscriptions on the show about 6 weeks ago, 5 or 6 weeks ago, And these subscriptions are a way to fund the show, but they also provide you with a lovely T-shirt and a resource DVD, which we mail out to you. And let me make it very clear that I've done this because it is essential for the show's longevity for the show to develop and continue, and it may be essential for me on a very basic level in order to survive. I've currently got about 11 subscribers, which has netted me a few hundred dollars. I just want to be very clear about it, that you know, this show has been funded completely out of my own pocket for about 5 years. And I've actually undergone quite a lot of financial hardship as a result of doing it. So great kudos to those 11 subscribers who have joined up. To the hundreds or thousands of others who've listened to the show, I'd just like you to consider that I'd like everyone to consider that we have a bit of a problem today with organizations like Facebook and Google and tools like YouTube that have created a precedent and have set in mind the belief that everything's got to be free, and that if it's not free, you'll find a way to get it free. And don't get me wrong, I think it's great that we can get a lot of stuff free. And having said that, you've got to understand, though, that the very, very powerful and rich, unbelievably rich organizations that are giving to you stuff for free, first of all, they've got a lot of money to spend, right? So it's not really hurting them. Secondly, it's not really free. They are selling your private information. So when you log on to Facebook, and you know, it's tracking you. Same with Google. When you use Google, it's tracking everything you do, and it's selling that information. So you are paying for the free stuff that you're getting. You're just paying in different ways. And the ways you're paying are actually quite harsh. I mean, you're being spied on. Your privacy is being compromised. And you're also being herded. You're being treated like cattle. They can control what you see. YouTube regularly changes the view count on things to make certain videos less popular. Facebook does all kinds of algorithms to change your news feed. And so you're not getting a genuine feed of the people who are your friends on Facebook. You're getting a controlled, homogenized news feed based on what they want you to think other people think. But this is all the free stuff, folks, right? And so you can carry on getting the free stuff and not putting money into shows like Truth News. You can carry on doing that. But if you are doing that, I'm really wondering how you can call yourself an awake person, how you can call yourself someone who is actually working to change or to liberate humanity. Because what you're actually doing is you're facilitating tyranny. You're facilitating your own slavery. And you're putting others down who are trying to actually step up. So have a think about that. I've put a lot of thought into it, and I think it's sound, I think, what I'm saying, and I think we need to look at ourselves, we need to re-examine ourselves, and we need to do this on a daily basis, because we are largely the creators of our own enslavement. So you look at your own behavior, you look at your own actions, and you may see a way forward there to actually improve your life and the life of others around the world. So if you would like to subscribe to Truth News Radio, please go to our website, go to truthnews.com.au right now and click on the big subscribe banner, which you'll see right there on the homepage. And you can go there right now and you can buy a subscription. You can either buy monthly or yearly, or you can buy a concession subscription, which will get you our wonderful T-shirt and DVD. Okay, let's return you to some news topics. Australia. Let's talk about Australia a little. Brisbane has recorded its coldest morning in 103 years. The Weather Bureau said the state's capital dropped to 2.6 degrees Celsius just before 7 a.m. Clermont in central Queensland had record low temperatures yesterday, but broke records again this morning, with the temperature dropping down to minus 4.5 degrees centigrade. Blackall recorded lows of minus 2 degrees centigrade, and Roma saw temperatures of minus 6 degrees centigrade. Actually, 6.6. That is incredible, folks. Minus 6.6 degrees centigrade is seriously chilly, ladies and gentlemen, and this is in Queensland. Queensland, a subtropical state. So there is some interesting information for the climate alarmists to ponder. And in other parts of the country, Glen Innes in New South Wales has recorded a temperature low of minus 11.3 degrees centigrade. Now, as I mentioned last week, there has been some new research, and this has come from a number of different sources, which really do strongly indicate that we are on the cusp of a new phase of global cooling. It'll be very interesting to see how the climate change debate pans out, if this is indeed the case, over the next 10 years or so. And let's talk a little more about the carbon tax, because that's what the climate alarmists have put in place to ensure that we don't keep getting hotter. Well, last week, the Abbott government was ready to submit the carbon tax repeal bills, but at the very last minute, they were blocked by Clive Palmer. And the question for that, the reason for that, is that he claimed that he was double-crossed by the government on some of the amendments that he wanted to pass for the carbon tax repeal bill, the most important being that power companies should refund the excessive amounts of money that they have charged customers since the carbon tax came in. That they must reflect that in their pricing, that the pricing must provide savings to people. I may have said that wrongly. I didn't actually mean refund, but I mean that in future the prices must reflect the drop in price. Now, Clive Palmer has been quite belligerent lately, and he's certainly been quite aggressive during news interviews. I've got a quick clip here to play for you from the ABC's 7:30 report. Here we go.
I'm sorry, Mr. Palmer, let me just come back.
I
beg your pardon,
I'm not discussing it with you any further, madam. It's subject to court proceedings where we're suing them for $600 million.
Yes, you've made that clear, but there are a couple of questions that you were prepared to take earlier on this week that I just want to clear up.
I'm not answering any more for you, so goodbye. We'll see you later.
That's Clive Palmer walking out of a 7:30 report interview. He's certainly got attitude, and I respect that. He's an interesting guy, and we'll talk a bit more about that when we come back from the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Well, we're talking today about the carbon tax repeal. And I'm playing to you at the moment a little clip here from Clive Palmer. I've got a report here from the ABC that he walked out of an interview with the 7:30 report on the ABC. So I just played to you before the break there, the final seconds of that interview, but I'm going to play it to you from the beginning now. So here we go.
I spoke with Clive Palmer a short time ago in New Zealand. The interview took an unexpected turn. Clive Palmer, welcome to 7:30. Now, you say that the government double-crossed you today, tried to pull a Swiftie on you. How did they do that?
Well, it's not about that, really. It's not about me. It's about the Australian people, making sure that they get all their reductions in gas and electricity prices if the carbon tax is abolished. We had amendments with the government. We looked at them last night. We didn't think they went far enough, and we didn't think they'd protect the rights of our citizens. So we acted, drafted a new amendment up this morning. The government was unable to accommodate us, and we thought we had a responsibility to them more than anyone else.
Now, just you did say that the government had a violent reaction to your amendments. Mm. What did you mean by that?
Well, I didn't mean violent in the sense that they punch you or something. I know they would never do that to us. But that we had a sort of simultaneous onslaught from all of our senators being visited by people from the government parties and their friends to suggest to us that what we were doing was wrong.
And what were they saying was wrong with the amendment that you were putting up?
They were saying it was unnecessary, I think, and that we thought it was necessary. And since that time, we've got more legal advice, which has confirmed our view. We had a provision that said that if people failed to pass on the lower electricity prices to citizens and you know, families and industries, they would have to pay to the government 250% of what they should have passed on. We thought that was a good incentive to make sure that our single mums and dads and also the pensioners and other people will get the a reduction in the electricity prices, because we can't see the reason to abolish the carbon tax if that's not going to flow through to the community. I think the government's of the same view. I hope they are. I hope we can work together constructively to ensure that electricity prices and gas can come down.
Let me just be clear about that, though. Are you saying that in the first instance the government pushed back hard against you on the issue of the 250% penalty for companies that don't pass on the savings?
Yeah, I think that was my understanding, and yeah, that was what was told to me by some of our senators. So I'm going on what they've told us, and if that's the case, well, I hope the government reconsiders it. I think they will. And I think in the light of day, this is only something that happens if people don't, after a year, agree to pass it on to people. I think the community thinks they're going to get it, and we're going to make sure they do.
Well, let's clear this up, because it's a little bit confusing at the moment, because mm-hmm. the government is saying that it was prepared to support your amendment and it was your senators who withdrew it.
No, they withdrew the amendment when it was clear that they wouldn't support it. They had a discussion with me outside, and not Mr. Hunt, but other people, and said that they, for technical reasons, they said they couldn't do it. They'd have to do it in the House of Reps, and they urged us to pass the carbon tax on the basis that they would attend to the matter in the House of Reps next week. And I said, no, you attend to it in the House of Reps next week, then bring it back when it's in the legislation and we'll be prepared to vote for it. I think that's the way, you know, that sincerity is always subject to proof.
Having a look at your actual amendment, to be clear about it, who are you saying it should apply to?
Well, what we're saying in essence is that any generators of gas or electricity in the country that have in their price structure a certain component for the carbon, that needs to be reduced, and that saving needs to be passed on to down the line to consumers.
Now, there is some confusion around tonight, because people who've looked at your amendment think that it goes much further than that, that it applies to any business that is that has had costs incurred through the carbon tax. Is that what you intended, for it to cover any business?
Well, I think it's pretty clear what it covers. There's a definition of an electricity producer and a natural gas producer, and it covers anyone that generates or deals with that commodity. It doesn't cover anyone else.
So it doesn't cover the airlines, it doesn't cover the supermarkets or anybody else who has carbon tax-associated costs?
In a reality, if the cost structure comes down, market forces will bring their costs down by competition. We know that. And that's a good and healthy thing. I mean, if Qantas doesn't want to bring down its savings and pass it on to its consumers, well, one of its competitors will, and they'll have to bring their prices down to compete.
You're not saying that your amendment actually includes those other companies within it?
No, I don't think it does, actually. But what I am saying is that in the case of electricity and gas producers, they're virtually in a monopoly situation with many of our generators held by state governments. They've got no freedom of choice and there's not a real market. We've seen $45 billion spent in the electricity market, for example. The demand for electricity has come down, the prices have gone up. So, you know, they've got nowhere to go, and we're there to help them.
Now, the business community reacted with some consternation today. They said that the amendment, as you've put it up, could cause mayhem. Do you think they've misunderstood what it says?
Oh, I think so. I think it's an overreaction. Of course, it's probably all the marching girls that support the Liberal Party out there, you know, the battery hens, and that they're probably rallying their troops. But, you know, we're elected to the Senate. We're pretty calm about it. We're not going to desert the Australian people. And that's just the way it is.
And as long as the government agrees to that 250% penalty, you will back the repeal of the carbon tax next week?
Well, there's a whole four-page amendment, which I understand they agreed to, and other than that, this morning. And if that's adopted in the carbon tax in the House of Reps, we'll be true to our word and support the government.
Now, while I've got you there, I just want to raise a couple of questions about the Chinese issue that's been bubbling along all week. You said earlier on this week that money from the port fund, that is the port fund you were running with your Chinese business partners, was paid to Media Circus, the election advertising company.
Yeah, well, hold on. I never said that. What I said was that we paid Media Circus for money that was paid to us for services that was provided by us, which is quite normal in a joint venture situation. For example, the ABC pays your wages. And if
okay, I'll just leave it there. The interview then deteriorates and leads to Clive Palmer walking out. It's a separate topic, and it's to do with allegations of impropriety, which are hard to evaluate, and I don't really want to invest time on the show today talking about that. What I would like to say is that having listened to Clive Palmer talking about what happened and listening to his perspective on it, I can't fault him on pressuring the government to make sure that the average people, get the benefit of the repeal of the carbon tax. It's a very important point. And so, you know, I'm glad that he blocked the bill until that was resolved. It's only going to be through smaller parties who are not totally controlled by the financial oligarchies. It's only going to be by virtue of their influence that we're going to get a good result in this case. And it was only ever as a result of grassroots activism that forced this carbon tax repeal to come into existence. The major parties on their own would both have brought in an emissions trading scheme. John Howard would have brought in an emissions trading scheme. Malcolm Turnbull would have brought in an emissions trading scheme. But through the scepticism and activism and, you know, passionate, committed people like Joanne Nova and Bob Carter and many other people who I've had on this show, Leon Ashby of the Climate Skeptics, and through the awakening of average people all over the country, it was realised that pricing carbon, whether you call it a tax or an ETS, is a scam. And people have had enough of it. People have had enough of scams. People who love the environment have had enough of scams. I love the environment. I want to protect the environment. But I'm not a lemming, you know, I'm not going to be just led down the path of protecting the environment by funding these big banks. It's just so silly. But Clive Palmer, I know, is getting a lot of criticism at the moment, and rightly so. I mean, it's important to be suspicious. It's important to be critical. But I'm just giving you my perspective on it, is that he is forcing the government to follow not just the letter of the law in terms of repealing the carbon tax, but actually to make sure that we get the benefit of that. Now, next week, it's going to go through again, and I will speak about it again once that bill has gone through, and we'll see what happens. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Thank you with Truth News Radio. I want to talk now a little about refugees in Australia. This is a topic which has divided our country in a way I've never seen it quite so harsh before. People are divided on the topic who are themselves truthers, people who are freedom fighters, people who are left, people who are right. The divisions on this question seem to affect people in every sector of our society. Someone that you agree with on 10 other things may disagree with you on this topic. Many of the people who listen to my show and many of the people who are my friends on Facebook have a position on the question of asylum seekers, which I deplore. And yet, these same people have a good grasp of what's going on in the world. They're not stupid. They're not asleep. They're not sheeple. So let's probe into it, shall we? I've got an article here that was written by Waleed Ali for The Age. And I think this article is quite a nice summary of some of the absurdities in the whole asylum seeker debate. Occasionally, you have to pause to take stock of just how bizarre Australia's asylum seeker debate has become. In summary, it works like this. The coalition implements a policy that is mostly Labor's, while pretending it is doing something so uniquely tough that no one else could possibly be so courageous. Labor, meanwhile, objects because that's what oppositions do, while trying delicately to avoid criticising the very thing it has unleashed. The mainstream public responds in poll after poll with a mix of approval and bloodlust. Some call for even harsher measures, though it is difficult to imagine what that would mean. Operation Sovereign Slaughter, perhaps. Events might punctuate this story, but they do not truly alter it. There's a death or suicide in detention here and a high court intervention there. These matter, but they don't matter. Nothing evolves. Nothing is reset. Whatever talk there might be that the Abbott government this week encountered its children overboard moment overlooks the fact that that episode did nothing to damage Howard's fortunes and that whatever demonisation of asylum seekers it might have embodied, that tradition is clearly flourishing. That's why reports of detainees' attempted suicides are seen not as tragic signs of unbearable mental pain, but as a cynical political stratagem dismissed merely as a rank blackmail. So for all the incredulity, all the outrage, all the lawyering that this week has produced, it's worth realising that we hardly crossed an intolerable threshold. At least not if that means we did something far beyond what we've done before. Perhaps the most confronting fact in all this is that whatever it is we did to those Sri Lankan boat people, there was very little that was new about it. And let's just briefly digress to talk about the Sri Lankan boat people. 153 Sri Lankan asylum seekers were seized at sea by the Australian Navy in international waters. Leading human rights lawyer and advocate Julian Burnside QC has told the ABC that the Australian government's holding of these asylum seekers may amount to piracy. On Monday, the High Court granted an interim injunction preventing the asylum seekers from being handed over to the Sri Lankan Navy. At the Melbourne hearing, Counsel for Immigration Minister Scott Morrison told the court that the asylum seekers' boat was intercepted outside of Australian territorial waters and therefore not subject to Australia's migration laws. Thus, the accusation of piracy. The asylum seekers say they are Sri Lankan, but left from India. However, Sri Lanka has said it will not take them back, and Abbott has said he has no plans to send them here. Okay, let's just continue now with the article there that I was reading to you before. Let's begin with the thought that by sending asylum seekers into the arms of the Sri Lankan Navy, we are returning them to their torturers. It's true that Sri Lanka's human rights record is poor on this point. Indeed, it was bad enough for Canada and India to boycott the Commonwealth Summit Sri Lanka hosted last November. It's also true that particularly in the case of Tamils, there are substantial grounds for believing that they are in danger of being tortured, and it's therefore an abundantly plain violation of the single most basic tenet of the Refugee Convention. But it's also true that we've done this before. Lots. We've sent people back to the Taliban to be killed for years, and in the case of Sri Lanka, we've returned more than 1,000 people. Only it was the previous Labour government that did it. Indeed, Chris Bowen, a then immigration minister, was proud of the fact. He'd call these returns steps forward because those are the terms of our public conversation. It's not a success when we resettle someone fleeing persecution. It's a success when we manage not to. The difference in Labour's case was that the returns Bowen was celebrating were voluntary. Faced with the prospect of detention in Nauru or Papua New Guinea, these people decided to go home. Scott Morrison's latest episode has seen them forcibly handed over to Sri Lanka. And at first blush, this seems a significant difference, but it is far less significant than it appears. That's because in both cases, there was no assessment process worthy of the name. We now know the present government is doing it by teleconference, asking four preliminary questions before rejecting them. It is this practice, as much as anything, that has the government sweating it out in the High Court right now. But again, it's hardly new. These days it carries the mocking name of enhanced screening, but it used to be called screening out, and some version of it has been around for decades. It's about the most cynical way there is of getting around the law. You don't even wait for an asylum application, you just press ahead with a cursory informal interview. If they don't say all of the right things about why they're there, you simply tell them that they aren't eligible and encourage them to give up. The trouble is that they typically have no idea of why they're being interviewed, so they often don't understand that they are being asked to make their case. And it's what they don't understand that makes this work a treat. You don't tell them this isn't a formal assessment. You certainly don't tell them that they have a right to go ahead and apply anyway. And for God's sake, you don't tell them that they have a right to a lawyer. You just daze them with bureaucratic smoke and hope they'll be confused and disappointed enough to go away. Usually they do, probably because they're under the false impression their application has been rejected. Suddenly, Labour's returns don't look nearly so voluntary. Good article. I'll put the link to that up on the site. You can read the whole thing. Key point to take home from this is that the two major political parties are simply working to the same agenda and they're blaming each other. They have bosses who are controlling everything. And when you see a situation like that, you have to be incredibly sceptical and you need to look into what is really going on. Whereas what I see many people doing, many people who are truth seekers, is falling into a, what I would call a rut of xenophobia, although you wouldn't probably admit it, but you are falling into a rut of xenophobia fear of the other. And using the concept of sovereignty, you have been persuaded that that there is a terrible threat here from these people. The threat does not come from these people, folks. And I know a lot of them aren't 100% genuine. I know that. And I'm not saying we should accept people who aren't genuine. But a lot of them are genuine. A vast number of them are genuine. And they are coming from countries largely, maybe not in the case of Sri Lanka, but many, many other parts of the world. They're coming from countries that we have bombed, that the American Empire has crushed and has created scenarios where people's life is destroyed, where they have become enemies simply because of their allegiance to a particular religious group or a regime. And so it's part of the apparatus of the global power structure that's created this situation. So that's one reason to bear in your mind when you're thinking, well, why shouldn't we be accepting these people? But the far more important thing to understand is that the numbers of people coming are not significant. They are not significant. What is significant is the numbers of people who are being brought here deliberately on labour programs by both governments, by Labour or Liberal, and that's in the order of hundreds of thousands, at least 200,000 a year are being brought in, and this is what is destroying our quality of life. This is what is undermining our wages, and this needs to be stopped at all costs. You're being distracted by a shell game. You're being distracted by this irrelevant, trivial matter of a few thousand people. It's a little more now, and it's more at the moment because of the horrendous things that have happened in Syria and Afghanistan. In other words, our own government has created this problem. You're being distracted by a shell game worrying about these refugees. Stop it. Wake up. And stop calling yourself an awake person if you're buying in to the xenophobic and racist fear of asylum seekers. I'm saying, sure, screen them. Send them back if they're not genuine. But get over the ridiculous brainwashing that you've been subjected to. Folks, that's the end of the hour. I don't have an interview scheduled for today. I will be replaying one of our recent great interviews, so do stay tuned for hour two if you're listening on the radio. And we'll be back next week. I'll see you then. Truth News Radio Australia, signing out.